Les colloques du Collège de France.
So I want to start by thanking Denis for putting together this great symposium so far, and Séverine for all the help. Also the technical team here at Collège de France, that they're working so nicely that we don't even see them. It's like they're invisible. So I also want to warn you that I had prepared a talk sort of more general public, sort of less specialized, and I'm going to be different from all previous speakers in the sense that I'll be talking about invertebrate systems rather than vertebrate systems. And I'll be talking about post-embryonic development. So I work with mostly with butterflies and other insects too, and development doesn't stop at the end of the embryo. You still don't have a butterfly. You go through all sorts of other stages, and very important things are happening in those. And I was very happy to hear Denis saying that he hopes that this will be the century that we care about variation. Because variation is indeed a universal property of all biological systems. Whatever phenotype in whatever species, if you compare individuals within one population, there will be differences. It's one sure thing that we have. These differences that I'll be talking about are mostly within species, so another level of variation. We've been hearing a lot about comparisons across fairly sometimes large distances, phylogenetic. I'm mostly concerned with sort of microevolutionary type of differences. Differences between individuals with one population, as Joost was pointing out to, are the raw material of natural selection, is what selection has to eventually derive differences across species that are then fixed. And there are many processes that we know contribute to this phenotypic variation. Mutation obviously introduces new genetic variants, development reads genotypes, makes phenotypes, and finally selection and other evolutionary processes filter phenotypic variation and leads to changes in frequency that happen across generations. Importantly, all of these processes are affected by the environmental conditions. Okay, I should be able to use this. No. That's why the environment there in green. So mutation, we very well know, it can be environmental dependent. Selection is obviously whatever phenotypes are fittest and will increase in frequency very much depend on the external environmental conditions. But also development doesn't always happen at the same in the same manner. So developmental rates and even developmental outcomes might depend on the environment. And there's beautiful examples of that. Maybe one of the most well-known would be the formation of castes in social insects, where being a queen versus being a worker very largely depends on how much and what you eat rather than what is in your genome. I've kind of put back this slide that I had removed for this talk in particular, again, going back to Denis, hoping for variation to be the topic of a lot of research. And it is already for quite a few years. There's a bunch of people trying to answer these questions of what is the genetic architecture of phenotypic traits? So how many genes, what are the relative contributions of different loci, allelic effects? Are these particular genes, for example, most likely, more often transcription factors versus structural proteins versus enzymes? Are there particular genes that recurrently appear as contributing to variation in different traits in different species? And I see Virginie Orgogozo, who is here, that has worked quite a lot on this, even trying to make a catalog of what we know about the genetic basis of variation to identify these potential hotspot loci. Which gene functions? We've heard a lot about protein coding sequence versus regulatory sequence, but there's all sorts of questions that are being addressed. I'm not going to sort of pause a lot in them, except to say that it is still not very clear to what extent are the genetic basis of variants that we're finding within one population, so again, the raw material for natural selection, the same that are then fixed and that we study when we do comparative development and compare the bats with the mouse or any other comparisons that you care about. Okay. So in my work, I've been using different insect models, as I was telling you, and within this big umbrella topic of the genetic basis of variation and diversity, we have paused over some particular topics, developmental constraints. Joost talked a little bit about those, to what extent do the rules of development limit what is possible to make as a phenotype, and as such, the directions of natural selection. Evolutionary novelty, and we already heard about a bunch of novel traits, the necks in tetrapods or the wings in bats. But also this idea of phenotypic plasticity, that the external environment affects development. And today, a lot of my work has then been focusing on eye spots, which are these particular pattern elements that occur on the wings of butterflies that are composed of concentric rings of different colors. And they're evolutionarily diversified. There's lots of differences across and within species, between males and females, between populations. They're ecologically relevant. We know that they matter, for example, to avoid predators, to get mates, so they're under sexual and natural selection, and to some extent they're developmentally tractable. So these organisms, we can keep them in large populations in the lab, we can do the sort of very classical developmental biology experiments of moving bits of tissue around on the wing to study how do cells know where they are on the wing and as such know what color to become. And they're becoming also more tractable from the genomics and genetic point of view. There are models for all these three topics that I told you about, and in particular, I work with a species that occurs naturally in sub-Saharan Africa called Bicyclus aninana. And then, unlike many other butterfly species, it doesn't really mind being around humans in the sense that they will mate, they will produce lots of eggs, they will produce pupa that we can just pile up in a petri dish that come out with and produce butterflies, so they don't need the individual attention that other species of butterflies require. So today I had indeed originally planned only to talk about plasticity, but then I decided that I'm going to do this triad that I touch both upon the idea of novelty, how do new traits come about, but also plasticity, and all going via immunity and the three-way interaction between temperature, pigmentation development, and immune function. And I'm hoping to make it through all these three points, but we'll see. Denise's going to signal if I go over time, right? I remember that. Okay, so I was telling you that I'm mostly looking at post-embryonic development. So once... I really should be able to make this work. No. So in the larvae, in the caterpillars, I'm sure many of you know this, all of you know this, there are already wings. So the caterpillars have wings. They're inside developing as imaginal discs. And it is in the larval wing. This is obviously an adult, but these are just stainings of very well-known proteins in larval wings. There's already the setup of the future color pattern. Okay, there's a bunch of genes that are expressed that are defining what will become the center of each eye spot. And in pupa, then these centers act as organizers. They produce a molecule that diffuses away to all sides and produces this concentration gradient of a morphogen, of a substance, that indicates to the cells on the wing epidermis how far they are from the producing center, and as such, what color they should become later on. Okay, so this happens in early pupa, and soon after, you have already the expression of rings of different transcription factors, all of these fairly well-known genes that are already determining what will be the future color that is only produced much later on towards the end of pupil development before the adult comes out. So even though these eye spots are considered a novelty in infallid butterflies, the fact that we see many of the genes that have been identified that are involved in eye spot development are genes that we all know. So they're not novel genes, and we've already heard about this. The recycling, you can, with the same genes, the way you use them, produce traits that are unique to particular lineages. So much so that these eye spots have been called a lot of things before, because they share sort of the logic of the circular rings of expression of different developmental genes. They were originally called by the lab of Shankar Carroll something like flat legs. This would be rings of expression in the developing leg of Drosophila. Or they share genes, this is in Grail, that are common with the embryo, and in particular with segment polarity establishment during embryonic development in insects. And I'm going to be pausing here. The fact that that there's commonalities between the way butterflies make eye spots, rings of color, and the way organisms just heal wounds, epidermal wounds. So this is kind of the same scheme, but now turned horizontally. So you have the pupa here, the adult here, and I've already told you about this series of steps that have to occur to produce the pigmentation patterns. What we also know is when you With a very fine tungsten needle, you make a hole on a developing pupil wing early on during development, and this window illustrated here by the plaque. So you kind of can see through the cuticle where are the different locations of the eye spots and the veins in the wing, so you can choose where to wound. And you leave this pupa B after you've pierced it. When you come back and you get an adult, you'll see that the hole has closed. So you had made a hole, there's no longer a hole. And around this location where you had wounded the tissue, there's the production of concentric rings of color that very much resemble the native eye spots. Okay? So this illustrates that potentially the mechanisms that they are using to put the eye spots on the right place were mechanisms that are shared and fairly well studied across different organisms that are also implicated in wound response, how a tissue deals with wounds. And I guess it's no surprise that wound response is fairly well studied and both across vertebrates and invertebrates, and some people have found both parallels in terms of the genes that are involved in response to wounds in the different groups, but also some uniqueness. In any case, what needs to happen when I wound a tissue, an epidermal tissue, is that I need to close the hole, okay? Because to restore tissue integrity. And typically also you have an activation of the immune system. Because what does a hole mean? It means that the likelihood of infection is greater, given that the integument is sort of the first great barrier of defense. So we asked the question of to what extent, and in insects, mostly through the roles of melanin. There's many commonalities between pigmentation and immunity, melanin being implicated in both. So we asked the questions, to what extent does the activation of the immune response that follows a wound play any role in the development of this pigmentation patterns that are ectopic around wound sites? And this was the PhD work of Adelina. So this brings me to this first point. And one of the things that Adelina did, she looked at the expression of a bunch of genes that have been implicated in immunity, in particular by either finding and killing pathogens or AMPs, antimicrobial peptides. And what she did is she saw that indeed the expression of these genes was upregulated by the wound. And in the in situs, you can see that, in fact, they're upregulated specifically around the wound site in these circular patterns. So it was clear that there was an activation of the immune system, we kind of knew, but then this justified the hypothesis that maybe the immunity plays a role in making these pigmentation patterns. If it does, the prediction is that if we have different levels of activation of the immune system, we will have differences in the ectopic pigmentation pattern formation. So originally, to test this idea, we thought, okay, let's just do wings that are in a completely sterilized environment with sterilized needles and sterilized everything versus wounds that are just made with the needle that I don't sterilize. But turns out that even sterile wounds will lead to an activation of the immune system. So we needed to find another way of having different levels of activation of the immune system. And so what Adelina then ended up doing was making the wound and then adding dead bacteria. So we heat kill our E. coli at different loads of bacteria, and with this hope to stimulate different levels of immune response. So she checked that indeed we were having stimulation of different levels of immunity in different ways. And in particular, you maybe don't see, but there's like little dots all over the place here, these melanotic spots that are often one of the responses to invading bacteria. Or again, the expression of two of those genes that I had shown you before, antimicrobial peptide glovarin and one of the melanogenesis gene, PALE, that are indeed expressed at higher levels as you go up in the level of immune activation. So then we wanted to see, so if I make a wound and I make do I affect ectopic eye spot formation? One of the possibilities is that I affect the probability that there is an ectopic, because the wound doesn't always result in an ectopic. But in fact, for all of the treatments, there was no difference in the proportion of the individuals that made these concentric rings of color around the wound versus the ones that didn't, are these little bits here. So the majority did. So no effect on the likelihood of inducing pigmentation patterns. But if we went and measured the ectopic eye spots, so what we see here is a wing that has been operated from the four different treatments that are also represented here. They're still there. And we measured the size of these induced patterns. And indeed, there were significant effects. So the higher stimulation of the immune system, the higher immune challenge, the larger the ectopic eye spot that was being produced around the wings. Obviously, the question, yours and the reviewers, what are the genes or what are the mechanisms that are involved? The fact of the matter is that there are a lot of molecular players involved in wound healing and wound response and in immunity. We had looked at those particular genes just to see that there was immune activation. It's hard to imagine that any of those plays any particular role. We do have sort of a favorite candidate would be JNK signaling, because we know this is a signaling pathway that regulates the expression of what are believed to be those morphogens underlie eye spot formation, but we have not tested it. But there's also all sorts of other things happening. There's calcium signals coming out of wound sites. There are physical factors, like just because you interrupt the integrity of the membrane, you interrupt surface tension. And there's obviously cellular components and the recruitment of cells to the wound sites. Okay. So I told you that wounds with a tungsten needle result in these eye spots whose size depends on how much you challenge the immune system. And as Adelina was doing this work, and she was putting her butterfly wings after she imaged them in envelopes, she started noticing that she also saw effects on pigmentation patterns on the other side of these wings. So this is the dorsal side, this is the ventral side, just the other side of the wing, and also on the hind wings. Okay, so it appeared that the stimulation of the immune system was having systemic effects also in the native eye spots. So this brings me to the second point. I've made it so far. And why this was particularly interesting for us, I'm going to tell you, it's because these eye spots are a model for thermal plasticity. We know that the size of those eye spots very much depends on the temperature at which development occurs. But before I go into that, so first we wanted to see if the effect of the stimulation of the immune system was also obtained instead with dead bacteria, if you just add a component of bacterial walls that is very often used in lab conditions, LPS, to stimulate the immune system. And indeed, she sees a difference. And also, if you were doing... so this is with LPS, this is without. It's a shame it's the other way around. Or if you would also see a difference in the native eye spot size when you did wounds that were not on wings. So it was not wounding wings, rather just wounding the thorax of the butterflies and depositing both gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria. And indeed, she found this effect to be prevalent. So I've shown you these two before. These are just a detached forewing and hindwing of wounds to which Adelina added PBS, or wound with E. coli. And remember, the wounds are made in pupil wings very early on during pupil wing development. And this is what we typically know from the developmental plasticity studies in the lab, that the temperature at which these organisms develop matters for pigmentation patterns. Okay, so if you have development at higher temperatures versus lower temperatures in the lab 19, you have very distinct pigmentation pattern, very distinct. Distinct pigmentation patterns, and certainly the size of the eye spots. And why we care about this, it's because of what is known about the ecology of the species. Okay, so these butterflies live in environments that are very seasonal. There's a wet season and a dry season. And if you would go into the field and collect butterflies from the dry season versus from the wet season, one of the things they differ in phenotypically is the pigmentation patterns. And this is presumably because the butterflies from one and the other season rely on different strategies to avoid predation. During the dry season, the butterflies are brown, as is everything else around them. And they rely on crypsis for not being perceived by predators. So their strategy for not being eaten is to be camouflaged against the background of dry leaves. On the other hand, on the wet season, the butterflies that you find flying in those same populations have clear eye spots, these markings along the margin of the wings. And these work to get the predator's attention towards the wing margin and away from the body. A butterfly can perfectly finely fly and make babies, make new butterflies, if it misses a bit of the margin of the wing, but it would die if it was attacked in the body. We know from studies in the lab that we can produce one versus the other season by changing the temperature at which they develop it. Yeah, this makes sense in relation to what happens in natural populations because there's a drop in temperature preceding the arrival of the dry season and an increase in temperature preceding the arrival of the wet season butterflies. So temperature works as a predictor of what will be the vegetation coverage that these butterflies will be exposed to, and as such determines differences in pigmentation pattern that relate to how you avoid predation. How do this? Do the tissues inside of the butterfly know that they're in one or the other temperature? Like many cases of developmental plasticity in insects, this is mediated by changes in hormone dynamics. So we know if you compare in terms of the percentage of time, a total time that it lasts as pupa, that the concentration of the active form of ecdysone, it's called 20E, there's an earlier peak if the butterflies are grown at the warm temperature and make the wet season versus the ones that grow at the cooler temperature and make the dry season. This is fine. This is established as a correlation. How do we go for causality? It's because you can have butterflies from the cool temperature so that it would be following here the blue line and you artificially bump up the level of ecdysone by injecting the active form of ecdysone and you do see that the eye spots become larger, okay? So these the difference in pigmentation that is due to temperature is mediated by temperature effects on hormone levels. So I go back to my butterflies that are changing in pigmentation pattern because there is a stimulation of the immune system, and it seems fair to hypothesize that maybe this effect too is mediated by differences in ecdysone, in differences in the levels of hormone in pupa. So to be able to establish that, I'd first have to check if immune challenge changes hormone titers inside of the pupa. And secondly, do the same type of experiment as before, where I try to manipulate to rescue the effects. So for the first part, what Adelina did was compare not only the butterflies from cool and warm temperature that we know how they behave and what to expect, but also butterflies with where she had wounded and added PBS, so low activation of the immune system, versus she had wounded and added either E. coli or another bacteria that I now don't remember which one it was. Okay, so what you see here is if you follow the levels, the concentration of this hormone, again, as a proportion of total duration of pupil development, indeed, the light gray, so just wound with little activation of the immune system, pretty much follows the red line, whilst the two darker grays follow the blue line. Yeah, so check, indeed, immune activation leads to changes in the levels of circulating ecdysone hormone. Does manipulating the hormone rescue the phenotype? It seemed like a no-brainer, but no. So what we have here is three treatments. All of them were wounded. The gray one doesn't have E. coli added, so just straight PBS. These two were immune stimulated. And again, we see from here to here a decrease in eye spot size, pretty much like we had seen before. But then when we try to rescue this effect by adding hormone and bumping these guys up there, we don't see an effect. There are several problems with this experiment, and this is why we're still working on it and it's still in prep. One of them is we might have injected too early, so we injected it around here, where the differences between the blue and the two dark grays are not that gray. Oh, sorry, with the grays and the red are not that great. And secondly, we had very, very high mortality, which is illustrated by here how many survived out of how many we injected. And we don't know how much that might be confounding our effects. Okay. So finally, I come to now talking about something that has little to do with morphology or the types of traits you typically study in a developmental biology lab, but all adult traits are the product of development. And in fact, and I'm going to guess that Nathalie is going to be talking about syndromes because it's in the title. So in these butterflies, there's seasonal plasticity. I told you about pigmentation patterns, but that's obviously not the single trait that changes across seasons or changes when you change the temperature during development. So I told you about the wing patterns and the distinct strategies to avoid predation, but they also vary in a series of life history traits that presumably relates to alternative seasonal strategies for the pace of life. Pretty much, these guys live fast and die young, and if you go to a natural population in the wet season, you can go through several generations of butterflies that are brightly colored. Whilst these guys, typically there's one single generation in the dry season. In fact, if you think about it, there will be little point in laying eggs at the beginning of the dry season and go through another generation because there are no plants to feed the eggs, okay? So their strategy is to invest in survival. These guys need to survive until there starts to be plants around again so that their progeny has a fair chance at surviving. So there's a series of traits here that relate to this. And we also pondered about immunity. It would make sense to us that there would be a thermal plasticity also in immune function, because the guys from the dry season, from the cooler temperatures, need to be better equipped to survive until the end of the season if they're leaving any progeny. Yes? So this was the hypothesis. And this was the PhD work of Yara Rodrigues, co-supervised with David Dunod, who's an evolutionary parasitologist. And if indeed the developmental plasticity in how soon you can reproduce is accompanied by developmental plasticity, thermal plasticity, in immune function, in particular, we expect that the dry season butterflies, so these guys, the ones that really need to make it until the end of the season, would have better immune function, would be better capable of surviving when they are infected. So the type of experimental design is that you have butterflies developing at different temperatures that produce the dry season, the wet season, then we put them at a common temperature, inject them this time with living bacteria that will effectively not only stimulate the immune system, but establish an infection, and then check daily for death. It's a lot of fun. And so if the guys that have better immunity will have a survival curve like that. So you start here with everybody's alive, and as the days progress, you start having death. And our prediction was that the ones shown in blue would be better able to survive and fight infection. And indeed, yes, this is what we have seen, but only for females. So females are shown in circles, males in squares. I know, not very original. And then the cool temperature in blue and the warmer temperature in red. So as we had predicted, the females from the cooler developmental temperature, so the ones from the dry season and natural populations, take longer to die relative to the ones from the wet season populations. On the other hand, we don't see any effect for males. This is not surprising if we then go back to think about when do they mate in their season? And it was not very clear until, in fact, after we had done this experiment, another lab was trying to figure out by dissecting butterflies from museum collections to try to figure out if the male, they mate early on and the females save the sperm in their spermatheca and only fertilize and lay the eggs at the end of the season. And that seems to be the case. So it is not very relevant that the males survive until the end of the season, as long as they have mated before and left the females with the sperm, and then they can die, they survive, and lay the eggs later on. Because David is an evolutionary parasitologist, we've been interested in trying to figure out to what extent are these differences in survival against infection due to changes in resistance versus tolerance, which is like a whole can of worms. And for that, we've been measuring bacterial loads inside individual butterflies that are shown here as dots, trying to fit a model to the data and try to identify how the different parameters layers of the typical lag curve that characterizes bacterial growth either in a petri dish or inside the hosts are affected by the developmental temperature. But this is work still in progress. So I did manage to talk about all of this, and this triad of temperature, pigmentation, and immunity, which is really curious because we have things affecting each other in all sorts of ways, and it's kind of this is a summary that I've shown you. Developmental temperature during both larval and pupal wing affects both adult pigmentation and immunity, whilst pupal the immune challenge of pupa affects pigmentation. What we do not know is the mechanisms, and we're looking into that right now, or even the evolutionary consequences. In particular, the effect of immune challenge on wing pigmentation leaves a very tantalizing cute ecological hypothesis, would be that butterflies carry on their wings information about what is their past infectious history, and thus could be used potentially as a honest signal in sexual selection, that they've survived infection, they're still around, so maybe they have good genes. Or if you think about sexually transmitted diseases, maybe a sign that I don't want to mate with you because you are infected and might transmit to me. So these are sort of hypotheses that we're playing with. I've said this already. Okay, so I want to thank in particular these three people that were the most actively involved in the work that I've presented, former lab members that worked on either of these topics, novelty or plasticity, the current lab members, collaborators, and the funding institutions. And thank you for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site. Collège-2-France.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.